This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, HRRN Nation, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk. It's all presented by Phasic Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna with you once again in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, extending a very special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206, and those of you tuning in on our website, on your smartphone, or on your tablet with our live streaming, all available each and every time we're on the air at horseracingradio.net. You know, over the past couple of years, so many trainers with the most recognizable names in racing have stopped by to visit with us on this show. Todd Pletcher, Bill Mott, Bob Baffert, and Richard Mandela, just to name a few. I've also had the privilege of talking with both John Service and Mark Cassie. And tonight, we're going to focus on the future stars of our sport with the sons of those two trainers. Blaine Service spent plenty of time learning from his dad, John, before recently going out on his own. And Norman Cassie, who is an integral part of his dad's team, he is, of course, the son of trainer Mark Cassie. Both of them with me here tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. I want to remind you, if you miss any portion of this show, you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net, catch a podcast of this program and all of our Trainer Talk shows, including the aforementioned shows with John Service and with Mark Cassie. They're all there for you to listen at your leisure and, of course, available on iTunes as well. Blaine Service has been around horses his entire life. He comes from a racing family. His grandfather, a jockey and a steward for many years. I mentioned his father, John Service. Well, it goes further than that. His uncles, Jason Service and Eddie Plesa Jr., both top trainers and both highly successful. So Blaine has every right to be a top trainer himself, and he is with us now on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Blaine, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And, you know, thinking back on what you've accomplished just so far, and you're just kind of getting started. You're 27 years old. You're now out on your own. 74 starts to date, 13 wins, 13 seconds, and 13 thirds. My friend, that's consistency.
Yes. Well, yes, thank you. And I try to pride myself on being consistent. And, you know, a lot of the first horses that I had, you know, that I started, you know, training with were horses that, you know, I claimed on my own, you know, for relatively cheap. And, you know, I had some privilege of my dad, you know, having an owner of his or so that had cheaper horses that they gave me a chance by letting me train for them.
What's been the biggest challenge in getting started thus far?
Definitely, you know, trying to pick up new clients and just, you know, really expand my business. And you know, for me, it's been a challenge because, you know, like you said, I've been pretty consistent and you know, I'm always, obviously, you know, unhappy. I'd like to win every race, you know, but I've been pretty consistent with in the money and everything. And, you know, the most important thing that I can do is have the horses that I train, whether they're 5,000 claimers or allowance horses or stakes horses, you know, just to have them run at the best of their ability. But I think the hardest thing has been, you know, getting myself noticed and, you know, trying to get more clients, you know, having those clients, you know, give me opportunities to train a horse for them. You know, that's been something that I've been working on every day. I call, you know, I go look on the internet or give people's numbers, and, you know, I call people just to let them know, you know, that I'm training and who I am, and you know, just trying to put my name out there and hoping that, you know, one of these people down the line will give me an opportunity.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you how a new trainer goes about acquiring new clients if they don't already have a relationship. You're pretty much just going through and cold calling owners in this sport and saying, hey, I'm here. If you're looking for a trainer, here's what I can offer you. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And I don't, you know, and I always tell them, you know, and I don't want to try to look like I'm trying to steal an owner from another trainer or anything like that. You know, that's never my intent. You know, I just, you know, and I told my dad about this before, you know, 90%, probably more than that, of the owners in the industry, you know, I have no idea who I am. So really, I'm just trying to, you know, just put my name out there and just let them know. And it's not even just that, like, oh, well, I'm trying to get, or I'm trying to tell this owner, you know, take your horses from your trainer and send them to me. You know, that's never what I say. You know, I'm always just telling them, you know, about myself and just saying, you know, if you ever, you know, have horses you want to send to Pennsylvania or to parks or, you know, just I would love to have the opportunity. Or if you know anybody, you know, it's just the fact of letting somebody know who I am, and who knows, they might run into somebody who's looking to send horses up here and, you know, drop my name, and that could end up being giving me an opportunity too. You know, it works in a lot of different ways.
Tell me about some of the clients that have supported you so far.
I've had some good support from friends that I've met over the years and stuff. And, you know, one of my dad's clients, you know, because I was an assistant for my dad for a long time. So one of my dad's clients that he's had for a long time, you know, I've known for a while and, you know, have went with my dad to business meetings with him and his partners. And, you know, that's Mainline Racing Stables and Dr. Bucky and all of his partners. And they're great people. And they really, you know, helped me out a bunch and gave me opportunities with a couple horses and even, you know, put out money to have me claim a horse that I was interested in claiming. And they've really done a lot to try to help me out, you know, get started. And, you know, they've seen what I've done for my dad and, you know, working for my dad and when he was in Florida, you know, being up here. And you know, I guess they had the confidence in me that they felt that I obviously they knew that I would do a good job, and I'm really thankful that they gave me the opportunity. And then I've also had other people, you know, some people that, because I've been to the sales with my dad since I was probably like 12 or 13. Like I went to a lot of sales with my dad throughout the years and met a lot of people, you know, and they've seen me pretty much grow up and be around the sport. And, you know, I've had some clients there that I've met that have given me opportunities and, you know, really helped me out by sending me a horse, you know, just any opportunity is really a big help for me, you know, just, you know, because the more horses I have running and the more the horses are running good and winning, the better off, better than me calling around and trying to put my name out there. You know, the biggest support for me and getting new clients is winning and seeing my horses running, you know. And my uncle, Jason, too, has helped me out with some of the clients that he's had. You know, he had a client that had a Pennsylvania bred, and, you know, he doesn't really, he'll ship to Pennsylvania, but he doesn't have horses at parks and stuff. So, you know, he helped me out by giving his owner my information, and his owner, you know, took the step in letting me have an opportunity to train a horse for him. So that was a really big help too.
What's the biggest difference with being the boss now as opposed to when you were working with your dad as his assistant?
Really, it's, you know, it's not too big of a difference, except that, you know, everything's on you. And, you know, you make all the decisions, you know, you are the difference between like winning and losing, you know. Before, you know, my dad made decisions and stuff like that. And, you know, I gave suggestions and we came together and stuff because we were like a team when I was up here and everything. But, you know, he made the final decisions. And even when it comes down to, you know, who you have working for you and everything like that. And, you know, when I became the trainer, you know, I got to make all those decisions on my own. And, you know, it's just great to, for, I mean, I guess some people wouldn't like all the responsibility for, but for me, you know, I love it. It's great for me. And I really, you know, cherish the opportunity to be able to, you know, to have all that responsibility and to have, you know, these people trust in me and believe in me to be able to train their horses and do the best with their horses and what's the best for them and their horses. And, you know, I'm really thankful that I can, you know, train horses and do what I love to do. And, you know, when you love it, it's makes it a lot easier. You know, it's not like a job where you feel like, you know, you're kind of dragging yourself to get up or anything like that. You know, I love what I do. So, you know, it's easy for me and it's very, very, you know, I'm honored to be able to train and to, you know, work with horses and do what I love. I really am.
Visiting with 27-year-old Blaine Service, the son of trainer John Service, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Blaine, were you there for the Smarty Jones ride when your dad was rolling through the Triple Crown with him?
Yes. Yes, I was.
That had to be a lot of fun. What was that like?
It was amazing. It was an amazing ride. It really was. You know, it was like a dream, really. It was crazy that was happening and the horse was running, you know, like he was. And it was just, it was amazing. I've never seen, you know, people, you know, be in love with a horse that much. And, you know, I don't know, just having all the attention on you like that. And, you know, it was crazy. And, you know, went through a run there for, you know, years leading up where my dad had some really, you know, big horses and, you know, when he had Jostle and everything. And I remember the first time I saw him on TV and I was like, wow, I can't believe my dad's on TV when Jostle won the Black Eyed Susan. They used to play it on ESPN. And I was like, wow, I can't believe, you know, my dad's on TV. And, you know, it was nothing like when Smarty, you know, was running, obviously, you know, going for that and having people just come up to you in the streets in Kentucky. And it was crazy. It was a crazy ride.
I remember people were having Smarty parties all over the country, and he really did sweep the United States with his run, and people really started to pay attention to horse racing because of him. Did you ever get to attend a Smarty party, or were you too busy working?
Well, at that time, I was in school, you know, and I went with my dad to the races and everything, and you know, came to the barn when I could and stuff. But you know, I was still in high school at that time. But you know, we went to, you know, we were all partying and stuff, you know, around the time of the Derby, you know, in Kentucky and everything. And it was amazing. You know, obviously, like, you know, all the people were, it was crazy. I've never seen anything, you know, like it before. I can't even really express, you know, exactly how it was, because it was something that, you know, I've never experienced before. And maybe you'll never experience again.
Yeah. Do you allow yourself to dream and to think about what it would be like if Blaine Service was going down that same path?
Well, you know, after the Belmont and everything, and, you know, I kind of set that as a goal for myself. And, you know, I've always kind of wanted to do that. And, you know, I think that's a goal of every trainer. Obviously, every trainer wants to have a horse that you know, is on the Triple Crown trail and has a chance to win the Triple Crown. You know, I mean, I'll be the first to tell you, you know, I want to be the first trainer since, you know, Seattle Slough to win the Triple Crown. You know, and as much as I root for, like, this year California Chrome and everything like that, but at the same time, you know, deep inside, I kind of want to be the first one, you know, and I'm sure every trainer does.
You started working with your dad when you were right around 16 years old. How would you describe his teaching method, Blaine?
He's just, you know, he's very hands-on and everything. And, you know, he just really, he knew that I had an interest and that I was really into it. And, you know, even back when I was in school, you know, I've always been the type of kid that, you know, asks a lot of questions and sometimes can even, I guess, be annoying with it, how many questions I ask. But, you know, I want to know everything. And, And, you know, he spent so much time with me and explaining things and, you know, teaching me. And it was, you know, I'm so lucky and thankful to have that. And, you know, it's such a big help for me, you know. And obviously the fact of him being my father is just an added reason for him to want to help me out and give me the chance to, you know, explain everything to me and, you know, to let me learn things on my own too, and you know, learn from my mistakes and stuff like that. And, you know, he really took the time with me and really, you know, told me when he thought that I was ready, and it really helped out. It was really an advantage. You know, he was very, very hands-on, and he wanted me to be like that. And, you know, that's why I started at the bottom. You know, when I started working for him, I started at the bottom where I was walking horses, and then I groomed for a while too before I even, you know, started being a foreman and then an assistant and everything. You know, he wanted me obviously to know everything, you know, and I pride myself on being that trainer, you know, that if needed, it is, you know, can groom and do all these things. And I know, you know, every aspect of the game. And I, you know, other than being a rider, because that's one thing, you know, I've always been a little too big to, you know, be a rider. But other than that, you know, he just really, I'm thankful that he took the time and really gave me the opportunity to learn from him and, you know, really helped me out a lot.
It sounds like he was a great teacher. I spent a lot of time working with my dad when I was about the same age as you were working with your dad. It wasn't in horse racing. It was a separate business. But how about when you would make a mistake? What were those moments like?
Well, it depends on what kind of mistake it was. You know, sometimes it was, sometimes he would get mad, you know, like anybody, obviously, you know, he would get mad, but he would, you know, it wasn't something like, oh, it's the end of the world or anything like that. And he, you know, like I said, there was opportunities that he gave me where he wanted me to make decisions on my own and that he thought it was better for me to learn from mistakes, you know? And, you know, he was very good at not just getting mad and just, you know, either yelling at me or something about something, you know, he would explain to me why, you know, why it was wrong and what it did, you know, doing it wrong, what it caused and why we do it this way. And that was a thing too. And that was a big thing with me asking questions. You know, I always ask why about everything, and, you know, cause I want to know why, you know, okay, well, we're going to work this horse this many days before a race. Well, you know, why do you work this horse this many days before, you know, instead of just saying, okay, well, you work every, you know, and just thinking, oh, well, that's the way it's done, so that's why we're going to do it. You know, I wanted to know why they did it and why they did everything they did. And you know, so that when I trained on my own, you know, I can make decisions and know why I'm making the decisions that I am instead of just, oh, well, I do it like this because this is how my dad did it, you know.
Yeah, do you find
decisions on my own because I know how to do it.
Do you find yourself taking that same approach with the people that work with you now, where you'll try to explain as much as you possibly can, and if something goes wrong and they make a mistake, you're using that as a teaching opportunity?
Yes, definitely. You know, I don't right now. I don't have that many horses, so you know, I don't have that much help right now. But the help that I do, you know, I really do take that opportunity and try to, you know, take the time and explain to them what's wrong and why we do it this way and why it needs to be like this. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have the help that has really been understanding and been open for that, you know.
Talking with Blaine Service on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. Blaine, how would you describe your training philosophy?
I'm very, I'm different with different horses. I mean, I think that's how you have to be as a trainer. You have to be, you know, you train every horse differently. I think, you know, it all depends on the horse and, you know, some horses, you know, like lighter training, some horses, you know, need to to be trained harder. And, you know, I'm all about, you know, just trying to have the horse be at the peak condition, you know, physically and mentally too. You know, I don't like rushing horses. I've been, you know, from the beginning, one of my biggest things is, you know, the patience with the horses and having, you know, the horses have a relaxed atmosphere and be able to settle and not be, you know, rushed or anything. You know, that was one of the things that I learned quickly that I really liked, you know, and was a big help for me was, you know, taking my time and having things done right instead of rushed. Because when you have a big stable, it's very easy to have people start rushing things, and that's where you start making mistakes, and the little mistakes can like lead to a loss, you know, the difference between winning and losing.
You know, one thing I found interesting as I was looking back through some of the things that you've done in your career outside of working with your dad is that you spent some time working on the starting gate at Parks, and that had to be a unique learning experience for you as well. Tell me about that.
Yes, it was. It was very exciting. I will say that, and it was very, you know, it was a good job, and it was, you know, the guys that I worked with were great, and they were a lot of fun, and it was a lot of fun. But it gave me, you know, a different aspect, you know, too, and a lot of the horses that we dealt with in the mornings and stuff and were the bad horses, you know, because they would have to come up and school because they were bad in the gate in the afternoon. And, you know, they got to learn a lot, you know, about, you know, why having the horses be used to the gate and going into the gate and not fighting and everything is so important. Whereas I guess a lot of people, you know, they send their horse up to the gate and they just want their horses to get ready to be okay so that they can run. And, you know, that's all they really care about. You know, if their horse is bad at the gate, you know, they don't really care unless obviously the starter tells them, well, you have to bring this horse up or he's not going to run. But, you know, I really got to see, you know, what effect, you know, a horse acting up at the gate can really have on the race, which a lot of people don't really see. You know, we had a horse that was a nice horse when I worked there that every time that he would come up to the gate would fight. So like would put on a fight, you know, just to get in the gate for like 5 minutes would fight. And he was a nice horse and won some races and stuff. But, you know, you could just tell just physically and mentally how flustered and how, you know, sweaty and everything he would be before the race. And, you know, never understood why it wouldn't just take the time to bring him up and try to have him relax more and just, you know, really have him, you know, be more relaxed going into the gate, and how it could have made a big difference and made him even a better horse than he was, you know, because at that time he was only running cheaper races.
Yeah, I've always said that the folks who work the starting gates in this sport are kind of the unsung heroes of the game. We don't spend a lot of time talking about those individuals, and I think that's a mistake, because what they do and that job in the starting gate is, number one, extremely dangerous. I think outside of being a jockey, maybe the most dangerous part of the game is working the starting gate. And then you look at everything that they have to do in order to make the race go smoothly and the start of the race go smoothly. What is the key, Blaine, to being good at working on the starting gate?
Well, one thing, you can't be afraid. You know, that's the first thing. And, you know, people will tell you that about horses from the beginning, even if you're walking horses, you know, you can't be afraid, because the horses know when you're afraid and they'll take advantage of it. And that's definitely evident, you know, throughout being around horses altogether, but definitely in the starting gate, you know, and, you know, you'll get in a situation, you don't have a choice to be afraid in the starting gate, because you'll get in the situation where a horse will flip, especially in the morning, where a horse will kind of flip and, you know, it can be scary and you break through the front doors and, you know, you got to bring the horse back around and get back in with the same horse, you know, and you don't really have time to be scared and it's not, you don't really have an opportunity to do that. And, you know, the biggest thing, the best thing to do and the thing to make it the best, you know, to be the best at just, you know, being a starter and not really the best, but just being a good starter, I guess, is to try to keep the horse as relaxed as possible while you're in the gate. You know, make sure he's standing right, and everything and try to keep the horse relaxed until right before the break. And then, you know, right before the break, you put their head straight, you know, right before they're going to break so that they break out straight. You know, the more relaxed you can keep a horse, you know, the better and the easier he is to work with and the less likelihood you have of him doing something drastic right before the break.
Visiting with Blaine Service on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Blaine, you talked earlier about going to the yearling and two-year-old sales with your dad and picking out horses and that he taught you how to pick out some nice babies. Well, what exactly did he teach you? What was that philosophy and your now vision when you're looking at horses? What is that?
Well, there's certain little things that we look at, you know, with the horse that, you know, things that we'll notice that, you know, will make us maybe cross the horse off when it comes to, you know, how physically, you know, how we think the horse might, you know, stand up because of certain things that we see. And there's certain things that we look at that we like, you know, that we look for in a horse that really makes a horse stand out, you know. And a big thing, too, is, you know, first impression. You know, when you first see the horse and, you know, some horses stand out more than others, and, you know, that's a big thing, too. But, I mean, one of the biggest philosophies that we've had, and, you know, and it has a lot to do with the owners that you have, too, and the kind of money that they're willing to spend and everything, too, is, you know, instead of looking for the great-looking horse with the perfect pedigree, because then you know that you're going to be spending lots of money, you know, you're better off trying to look for the great-looking horses with the okay pedigrees, you know, where you can get maybe more horses for the same amount of money as you would maybe get one horse with a great pedigree, I guess, is the biggest thing. You know, try to maximize the opportunities and the number of horses instead of just putting all your eggs in one basket and getting one horse for maybe 200,000. You know, maybe you can find four horses with not as nice a pedigree that might even look better for 200,000.
Well, Blaine, I feel like we've just scratched the surface with what you're trying to accomplish and your background, so we'll have to do this again. Once you get to that 1,000 win plateau, when you hit that milestone, we'll do a whole new trainer talk, and we'll talk about those other big wins you've had along the way. But want to thank you for taking the time to be here with me tonight. All of our guests that appear on the program received a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. They're one of the sponsors of the show. I'll send those to you, and again, really appreciate it, and all the best moving forward. Good luck.
All right, thank you very much. I really appreciate you guys having me on.
All right, Blaine Service on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Again, just getting started. 13 wins, 13 seconds, 13 third place finishers from 74 starters. That's pretty darn good. And that's ultra consistent. He learned from one of the best, and his dad, John, his uncle, Jason, and Eddie Plesa Jr., also his uncle. Yeah, he's got some pedigree to him. Second half of the program coming up next, we'll visit with Norm Cassie, the son of trainer Mark Cassie. Stay tuned. It's Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.
The Fasig Tipton Yearling Sales, your roadmap to success. In 2014, the Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, July Sale, and New York Bred Sale were ranked the top three sales in North America by rate of return. And the July Sale was once again a top-ranked sale by percentage of graded stakes-winning graduates, with an average of more than $94,000, including undefeated leading Kentucky Derby contender, Dortmund.
Dortmund is all heart. He shifted his ground a little, but he's clear. And Dortmund, another stylish performance. Dortmund wins.
The Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale is annually the number one ranked North American yearling sale by percentage of Grade 1 winners. In 2014, the Saratoga Sale boasted a $291,000 average and a median of more than $237,000, with past graduates including Grade 1 Don Handicap winner Constitution and the brilliant juvenile champion American Pharaoh.
American Pharaoh will romp home in the Rebel.
It's never too late to nominate, so make plans now to sell your yearlings at the leading sales in North America. Visit FasigTipton.com to nominate today.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreads.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Xacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms, mgive.org/chi.
Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick Four. You hear him on HRRN Radio. Now get his personal selections directly from him at his new site, PopeJude.com. Every analysis sheet at PopeJude.com has his personal selections and insights. Each page is a handicapping lesson packed with years of racing knowledge, coupled with insider information gleaned from the pontiff's countless connections in thoroughbred racing. Whether you're looking for another set of eyes on the past performances or inspired racing analysis to assault the windows, PopeJude.com is the site for you.
This Saturday, HRRN brings you Grade 1 racing from around the country with the Santa Anita Derby, the Bluegrass Stakes, and the Wood Memorial. Tune in beginning at 4 p.m. Eastern as our award-winning team takes you to Santa Anita, Keeneland, and Aqueduct for live coverage of these crucial Derby preps. Go to horseracingradio.net for affiliate information and to listen live.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. If you missed any portion of the show so far, simply go to our website, horseracingradio.net, to podcast of this program and all of our Trainer Talk shows, all of our shows for that matter, available at horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Welcome everybody back joining us throughout North America, Sirius 220, XM 206, and of course streaming worldwide, horseracingradio.net. Fun visit, first half of the program with Blaine Service, just getting started with his own career after working so many years with his dad, John. Well, Norman Cassie has also spent an awful lot of time working with his dad, and he has learned from one of the best. His dad is a six-time Sovereign Award winner as Canada's leading trainer. And he has trained more than 1,800 winners, including the winners of countless graded stakes. And Norman, make no mistake, he's a major part of that success. And he is with us here tonight to hear tell his story. Norman Cassie with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Norman, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate you having me on today.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. You know, I had a chance to visit with your dad on this program, and we were just getting it off the ground a couple of years ago. And he was so candid about his life and everything that he's gone through. And he talked about his family and how he came from a racing family, which means that you come from a racing family as well. And I know that you're learning from one of the best. With all those highlights that I just mentioned, what's your favorite moment so far in being such an integral part of your dad's career?
Far and away, I think my favorite moment would have to be when Pull Play won the Stephen Foster. And it was only because, you know, it was a horse that I was more involved with than the rest of the horses. But more importantly, it was on Father's Day weekend, and I had told Dad that I thought you know, I was going to give him a really special Father's Day gift, and the horse delivered. And I don't know. I think that's probably going to be something that I'll remember for the rest of my life.
It's going to be hard to top that one. And, you know, when you think about the Cassie Racing operation, your dad is the trainer of record, but it really is a team effort, isn't it?
Yeah, he you know, he oversees everything, and he makes all the important decisions, but he really relies on his team that he's put together to tell him what he needs to know, and then when it comes down to it, he's the one who makes the final decisions. But he trusts us a lot, and you know, he's had a hand in the way that we've all developed, all the assistant trainers, so he trusts us. And at the end of the day, he makes the final decisions. But it's a very, very organized system, and it's pretty successful.
Was your dad there with you the day that Pool Play won the Stephen Foster?
He was there, and it was emotional. It was emotional for all of us. I couldn't even look at him because I would have teared up. And I get goosebumps talking about it because it just was such a special moment for all of us.
And you guaranteed a win. You were kind of like Babe Ruth guaranteeing a home run.
I know. I was a little more brash back then. I was very, very confident. And, you know, sometimes horses just give you this special feeling. And I thought if things went his way, he was certainly going to be tough. And everything set up perfect for us that weekend. And, you know, you just remember moments like that.
I can remember when I worked in the racing office at Keeneland years ago, and people would always ask me about certain horses and certain trainers, because I was working in horse ID, so I worked closely with most of the trainers, and they would say, you know, does so-and-so like his horse in today's race? Well, every trainer likes his horse. They wouldn't have him running in that spot if they didn't like him. But can you tell when a horse is sitting on a big race? Is there something that he's showing you that you just know, hey, this is going to be his day?
I think it's actually months leading up to race. Maybe not months, but you really have to have a horse coming into a race that has worked consistently well and is doing all the things that you want to see. And, you know, with any type of athlete, you just want to see a horse that's happy. You want to see a horse that's not missing any type of important steps leading up to a race. And like with Pool Play as an example, for about a month he had a great month at Churchill where every work was better than the next and continued to gallop with a lot of energy every day and, you know, never missed any feed, all the cliche things that you hear all trainers talk about. But those are when, as long as you're in the right spot and you're in a position where you can win, those are the horses that are telling you they're ready to run a big race.
Visiting with Norman Cassie here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. All right, Norman, take me back to the beginning, because for you, not only did you come from a racing family, which we can talk about, but you actually had a love of horses from a very young age. I read somewhere that you actually had a rocking horse on springs, like most kids did, and you had it all done up with the polo bandages and everything, right?
I think the first memory for me of when I knew all my family was involved with horse racing was sitting on the floor in our house by Belmont Park. So that must have been when I was 3 or 4 years old, way, way back, and having my rocking horse that was done up with polo stuff. But I also had a miniature figurine horse with that dad had put little bandages and stuff onto that, the jockey on it. So obviously I've been involved with it my entire life. I guess Churchill Downs is probably my favorite racetrack, and I'll probably take a lot of heat for saying that, but Churchill Downs is my favorite racetrack because that's the place that I remember going to the races first, and it holds a special place for me.
Yeah, people think of Cassie and they think Canada because of all the success that your dad and yourself and the entire team have had up in Canada, but you were born in Louisville, and the Cassies are from Louisville.
It's actually funny. My dad's from Indiana. My mom is from Ocala. Somehow we just ended up in Louisville, obviously because dad was one of the leading trainers at Churchill in the 80s. But, you know, my brother and I, we grew up in Louisville. We've lived in Louisville our whole lives, and as I alluded to earlier, Churchill
Churchill and Kingland were the two racetracks that I remember going to the races to first. And that's where I kind of fell in love with horse racing, with those two places where horses are still revered. And, you know, I feel grateful and blessed to have been born in Louisville and grown up in that area.
Did you ever have to make any other equipment changes on that rocking horse?
I don't remember anything. I remember riding, but I don't remember any other equipment changes.
No blinkers on or anything.
I know I had a whip. The rider did have a whip that day.
Did you ever think about wanting to be a jockey?
No, I'm a pretty big, I'm pretty stocky guy. There's no way that I could have been a jockey. I galloped horses until I was about 10 on a farm, and I came off one day pretty bad. And I really never got on another horse until I started working on the backside in the capacity that I'm working in now.
All right, so when did that start, and how did you kind of get involved with working around the horses? Obviously, it was through your dad, but take me back to that moment.
Well, you know, Dad never pressed me into it, and the funny thing is that you just were talking about John Service, because truthfully, Smarty Jones is the reason why I fell in love with horse racing. I was born and raised in it, but I never really became fanatical over it until Smarty Jones won the Kentucky Derby, and that took me to a whole nother level. So that happened while I was in college. I was probably a freshman and sophomore in college, and once that happened, I just became a huge, huge fan, and never thought that I would have what it takes to work on the backside, be a trainer. Never thought that I'd be able to do that. I thought I'd be a bloodstock agent, or maybe a racing official, or maybe a member of management at a racetrack. And then just more and more, I just decided that my heroes were trainers, that my dad was a trainer, that my heroes were trainers. And I said, you know what, that's what I want to be. And I told my dad, and he was very, very proud and happy to hear that. And as soon as I graduated college, I drove right up to Woodbine and became a hot walker and started from scratch. And that's probably been 7-8 years now. And, I'm proud where I am now.
You said your heroes were all trainers. Outside of your dad, who were some of the other trainers that you looked up to at that time?
I wouldn't say that all my heroes are trainers, or all my heroes are trainers, but I look up to the guys that are real professional, the ones that are well spoken and present themselves and their horses in the best manner. And I've always looked up to Todd Pletcher, and I've always looked up to Wayne Lucas, those type of guys that, you know what they remind me of? They remind me of college basketball coaches. And I also have a great deal of respect for those guys as well. So those are the guys. Those are the guys that I want to be like.
Yeah, well, Wayne was a college basketball coach.
I don't think that's a coincidence. I think there's a reason why. I think that's why he is the way that he is, and that's why Todd acts the way that he acts. You have to be professional. You have to be well-spoken. You got to have people have to have respect for you. And those guys, including Dad, they have a lot of respect. And they just present themselves in the right way, and that's what I look up to.
So now you're competing with Todd Pletcher and Wayne Lucas and these other individuals on a daily basis. So what's it like knowing that, hey, we're not just competing, we're able to compete and be right there with these individuals day in and day out? What's that like for you?
It's just really rewarding. Over the last 5 or 6 years, we went from – I actually shook my head the other day because it wasn't actually a good weekend, but it was a weekend to reflect. When Dancing Moon ran in the Tampa Bay Derby, we had him at Tampa. We had multiple starters at Gulfstream, and then we had multiple stakes runners at Santa Anita. And here I'm thinking, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we were just a Woodbine outfit. We were winning tons of races at Woodbine, but outside of that, we were not unknown, but we weren't necessarily a North America presence. And now every weekend we're competing in some of the biggest stake races in the country, and we're running against the best trainers and best horses in the country. And you just got to sit back sometimes and just realize how far you've come and where you are and where we might be going. And I don't know, it's surreal sometimes. It's very, very humbling.
What's the most rewarding thing about training horses?
I think just when you know you have a good horse, you believe in that horse, you've touted that horse to your friends and family and maybe to other people, and he delivers the way that you would hope. That I think that's the most rewarding thing. The fact that you work hard, you get up 7 days a week, you're with the animal every day, and you get to see your hard work translate into a win, that's when you're rewarded.
You ever give any thought as to what you would be doing if you weren't training horses?
I think I would be working in some sort of capacity in the racetrack. When I first started college, I have a business degree, and my goal was to work as, you know, in some sort of racing management position, whether it be an executive at Churchill or Kinglin or wherever. But at once college started, I knew that I was going to work some capacity in the horse industry. But, you know, my passion is completely 100% behind training horses and becoming a successful trainer, and that's what I want to do.
Yeah, you graduated from Bellarmine University in Louisville, and you mentioned that business degree, so you did have that going for you. That has to help when you're running a training operation, and I know your dad's the one handling most of the heavy lifting at this point, but you're still an integral part. That business degree and that business background certainly has to help with any trainer, doesn't it?
I think it's very understated how important that is, especially when you become a national trainer where you have horses and divisions and multiple locations and cities. That's one of the keys to our success is how organized and our business is and how we communicate in the way that we document things. And that's all business oriented. And, you know, I feel the most important thing I learned in college was communicating and being able to communicate with everybody. I will have to, you know, I do radio shows. I talk to owners that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and I'm not intimidated and nervous because of what I learned in college.
Were you nervous coming on the show with me?
Oh yeah, just because I have so much respect for you and what you do. So yes, I'm very, very nervous.
Norman Cassie here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Norman, what's the biggest lesson that your dad has taught you?
You know, you're not the first person to ask, and it's I think almost with certainty that it's patience. There's been a lot of horses the last few years or since I've started that I think most people would have gone on with. They had little nagging injuries that were manageable. Dad takes his time. If we need to stop on a horse and give him a break, he will do that. And it usually works out for the best for everybody. I've seen multiple horses that ended up becoming stakes winners because we've done that. So I think patience and just the way he organizes his business is definitely what I've learned from him.
Do you have a horse that really sticks out to you when you actually think back on it? Maybe the first horse that comes to mind that you really fell in love with that your dad had, that outside of pool play, I know you talked about him, but is there another one?
Well, probably a horse named Plenty Proposition, who broke her maiden ultra impressively at Churchill as a 2-year-old, and we didn't get to run her back until her 3-year-old year, and she ended up beating Royal Delta. So just horses like that. And I have another horse named Skyflight that, although he's not a major stakes winner, as a 2-year-old, I really liked him. He was at Churchill, and he wasn't 100%, just wasn't 100%. We never got to start him. There was never any definitive reason why he wasn't doing well. He just wasn't. Dad said, let's just stop on him. And as soon as I got him back, you know, 5-6 months later, we started right back where we where we ended, and he ended up becoming a stakes winner. So just horses like that. And those are just two examples. It happens every day.
I read an interesting piece as I was kind of prepping for the show that after you graduated from Bellarmine, you were kind of at a crossroads. You talked about that. You weren't exactly sure which way you wanted to go. And then in 2005, you went with your dad on his first trip to the Kentucky Derby, and that was with a horse by the name of Seaside Retreat. And that had to be a very special moment as well. Tell me about that experience.
Well, obviously, that was kind of like, that sealed it for me. It was just at that point, I had to approach Dad and tell him my plans. Smarty Jones kind of got me started, and then when we did the walkover with Seaside Retreat, I knew officially what I wanted to do. But, I mean, it's hard to describe it without sounding too corny or cliche, but it's everything that you hear everybody talk about. It's a dream come true to have a horse in the Kentucky Derby, especially when you're somebody like me who, I will admit, it's really the only thing I care about. But like, I love horse racing. I love the Breeders' Cup. I love everything. But I think at the end of the day, the Derby's why we're all here. And people might disagree with me, but the Derby is so, so important. And, you know, like I said, it's hard to not sound cliche, but it's just a dream come true when you have that opportunity to be a part of something so important.
Yeah, especially growing up in Louisville, it holds a little extra special meaning, doesn't it?
I think, and you know what, and maybe that's the way, that's part of the reason why I act and say the things that I do, because to some people, it's just a horse race, but in Louisville, it's a whole event, and I'm telling you, you take it, you don't realize, like growing up, we have a very distinctive last name. Not too many people have it, obviously. And,
sure,
you know, I played baseball in high school, and I would come to the plate, and they'd announce my name. And the umpire would literally take his helmet off or his mask off and say, "Your dad's a horse trainer, huh?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And it just shows you what horse racing means in Louisville. And then you, obviously the Derby is much more important even than that. And it's just, you know, the scale of it, it's hard to describe, but it's just very, very important.
You mentioned playing baseball. Is that the only sport you were involved with?
Yeah, it was the only one that I really loved. I never played anything else. I'm not really the most athletic guy, but because I grew up playing baseball and I was so passionate about that, I was good enough to make it to a Division II school, and I was proud of that. But once you got there, you realize, hey, my hard work's not going to just cut it anymore. These guys are on a different level than me, and then that's kind of like where the dreams die when you actually see. I can't even imagine what it's like to be a Division I or a professional athlete, because even the Division II schools, they have great players, and, you know, I just couldn't stack up anymore.
Well, it's probably a great parallel for horse racing, too, because we see horses that compete very well at grade 3 levels, grade 2 levels, and then, of course, the exceptional ones at grade 1 levels. There really is that distinction with horses, too, isn't there?
I believe so. And it's just, you know, like, almost from day one, because they just do things with so little effort compared to the other ones. And it's just like, hey, you know, you'll call and tell Dad immediately, "I think this horse is a runner." And he'll say, "Well, what makes you think that?" It's like, "Dad, this thing, he does things effortlessly." And that's what I think those guys are like. So yeah, there's definitely a parallel.
How often do you talk to your dad during the day?
There's at least one phone call a day. Usually as soon as I'm done training. He doesn't normally bother me during the training hours because he knows that I'm on the pony or I'm with the blacksmith or whoever I'm with. But at the end of the day, we'll talk about the most important things that need to be discussed. You know, if we're going to enter horses that we were originally going to enter, and we just clarify things. But mostly everything that we discuss and important things that need to be documented are all done on a spreadsheet on a computer. And all of us, and by all of us, I mean all the assistants across the country, will send the same spreadsheet, although it will be different because they will be their own horses. They'll send it all to Dad, and then he puts it on a master spreadsheet, and then sends it all out to us at the end of the night. So we all know and we're all on the same page.
All right, be honest with me now. I worked with my dad for a long time, and I know the old saying, don't work with family, okay? Does it ever get to the point where you look at your phone and it says, Dad, and you say, oh, what does the old man want now? Is he calling me again? And you send it to voicemail?
I would never do that because he would get too angry about that. Honestly, I'm very, very laid back. I'm very passionate about the horses, and when we have a bad day or a horse runs bad that I thought would run really well, I'll get upset. But other than that, I'm pretty laid back. And, you know, some people don't want to work with their dads because they're working with them side by side every day. I'm not saying that I couldn't work with dad side by side, but we try to not be together. And that's not because we don't want to be together. It's because most of our owners are comfortable with me being with their horses if dad's not there. So we're kind of like the president and vice president. We're really rarely in the same room or in the same capacity, and that's not because we don't love each other and that we don't want to be. It's because that's the way that the business is dictating. And so really, when I talk to dad once or twice a day, it's not a big deal.
Yeah,
I'm more than happy to talk to him.
It really comes across as a warm, loving relationship, which is how it should be, and the work part is really secondary, and it does seem as if you do get along very, very well, at least from what it looks like from the outside, for sure. Norm, how about going out on your own? Is that something that you give a lot of thought to at this point, or is that just up the road?
No, I mean, I really, really want to. I just, it's you know, it's a financial game, and I want to have my finances in order, and I want to have a legit plan in place before I do that, because so many guys who are probably more capable than me, and I'm not selling myself short, but there have been plenty of people who are very capable, try to go out there and do it, and it's so hard to do, and I'm not going to fail. I don't want to fail because I'm not financially ready or because I don't have a sound plan in place. I want to fail because I'm not good. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I want it. I'm a very organized person, and I want it to be organized in a way that I'm confident that my abilities and my horse's abilities are going to be what dictates our success, not anything else. And when I feel like that is in place, then I'll do it. And I'm sure dad will be more than happy to let me go, because he knows you don't work as hard as I do, and you know, you don't put in the hours and everything just to be the second in command. He knows that I want to go on my own and what my goals are, and it's just a matter of time. It's just when everything's in place.
Norman Cassie on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Norman, just a minute and a half or so left here in the program, but I always like to end by asking trainers what it is they like to do outside of horse racing. You play baseball. Are you still involved with being, well, I guess, a fan of baseball?
I don't really follow. I follow the Blue Jays, which were always my team. But, baseball's become very hard to watch. I hate to admit it, but I'll follow and I'll look at the results of the games every night, and I'll follow along what's going on. Mostly, you know, it's funny, the thing that I've really become passionate about, other than horses, is exercising and weightlifting. And I think it's because it helps me so much relieve stress. I go immediately after we're done training or after I'm done running races or whatever, and I may be in a bad mood or taking things the wrong way or whatever, and I'll go and work out for 45 minutes to an hour, which is my alone time, and I'll come out there like a new man. So that's really all I have. I have horses and I exercise, and that's what I do.
He's Norm Cassie.
I like college basketball a lot. So those are my three things.
Kentucky Wildcats, Louisville Cardinals.
I'm more Louisville. I follow both programs, but I am born and raised in Louisville, and I'm not afraid to admit that I'm more of a Louisville Cardinal fan than basketball. I'll take a lot of heat in Lexington, but I'm willing to do it.
Norman, appreciate it, buddy. All the best moving forward. Say hello to your dad. Like all of our guests, we'll send you a gift from Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those out to you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Norman Cassie here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic. Tipton Blaine's service in the first half. If you missed any portion, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.